It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis has the day off, but Mike Elgin's here. Barry Schwartz from SearchEngineLand.com. Why did Twitter appoint a Google stalwart to run the board? I have some theories. We'll also talk about notifications, both new notifications from a new Facebook app and no notifications from Chrome. A lot to talk about, and you got it. Coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 322, recorded Wednesday, October 14th, 2015. More than half mobile. This Week in Google is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/twig. And by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to Harry's.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code TWIG when you check out. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is traveling and unavailable today, but that's not anything to worry about because look who we have. Mike Elgin, news director at Twit.
Now that's something to worry about.
And for the first time you've been on this show, you're using a computer.
It's a computer. It has a keyboard. I figure everybody's doing it.
You're using a Mac. Is this a new Mac, or you just decided not to use your Pixel?
This is the Mac. I like to switch it around, flip, you know. But this is, frankly, I'm too lazy to come up with a novel device to use. I'm just using my regular laptop.
Also here, and I don't know what he's using, Barry Schwartz from Search Engine Land. Great to have you here as well.
Great to be here. Big honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, no honor at all. We're honored to have you. We love Search Engine Land.
I'm using a Mac also.
Oh, shoot. Me too. What are we doing this week in Google? This is crazy. Let's just make it Mac Break Weekly and be done with it.
Google, send us a gross of pixels, and we'll all be using those.
Actually, I'm really, and I was talking about this before the show, I'm waiting in a couple of weeks. I'll have the new Microsoft Surface Book.
Yeah.
And I'm actually seriously thinking I'm going to try to use it full-time for a month.
Yeah.
Like, not use Windows for a month. That is a challenge for me as a Mac user for many decades.
Yep.
But we'll see. We'll see. I feel like Windows 10 is pretty nice, and I'm really looking forward to using the stylus and the touch. And I also feel like once you get used to using touch, you want to touch the screen. I find myself touching the screen a lot, and I think this was with the Pixel. That's one of the things I love about the Pixel. And it's funny because this is like the Pixel. It's 3x2. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Instead of 16:9.
What I want, they have the big chrome bases. They're giant screens. They're designed to be
proper. You had that for a while.
Well, yeah, we reviewed it for Before You Buy. And it's so close to being the perfect computer for me.
Because
it's just too slow.
Yeah.
It's too slow. I need a Pixel version of that. The high res, beautiful screen, fast performance version of that, and I'm done. That would be the computer I would use full time. Well, not full time because it's not mobile.
But Microsoft's Surface Book is the same size as a Pixel, 13-inch screen, but it's higher resolution. It's 3,000 by 2,000.
Yeah, it's a beautiful.
So
beautiful
screen. That'd be interesting to see how that is. I mean, I think the Pixel looks great.
Yeah. The only thing I'm worried about, and you can confirm whether this is a problem or not a problem with the Surface Book, is whether or not when you rip off you detach the top, you're looking at 3 hours with the tablet.
Yeah, that's a little light.
That's as just a tablet, forget about the keyboard, that's the worst battery life of any tablet.
We talked about that on Windows Weekly, and Paul was of the opinion that, you know, if the reason they did that is if they had put enough battery in there to go longer, it would have been tippy.
Yeah.
And so they really wanted to, that's why the weird hinge. They really wanted it to be stable. A lot of touch screens, you start touching the screen, they actually fall over.
Yeah.
I haven't had that problem with the Pixel. Right. That's a big, heavy thing. Right. But if they put more battery in the lid, apparently, it would just make it top heavy.
And also, remember, you can detach it, flip it around, and close it so that then you get all 12 hours. You have to carry around the big bottom part as
So you only get the three-hour battery life when you insist on the super thin tablet.
Right.
Otherwise, you can use it as a tablet and still get 12 hours of battery life. It's also, I think, has to be said that they did all kinds of engineering gymnastics to make sure it wouldn't tip over, especially the hinge. The whole point of the hinge, nobody understands this unless you've been watching a Windows Weekly. But it what it does is it makes the bottom of the back go back further so that it doesn't tip over. So that the hinge sort of unrolls, so the actual distance from the very front of what's on the table to what's the back of what's on the table is an extra inch.
Right.
Right? So that's what that hinge does. And everybody wonders why the crazy hinge, but that's what it's all about.
It also looks pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Which you can't deny. Now, I feel like the Chromebook Pixel is in many ways a perfect computer. So I'll be interested to see. I think 3x2 is not a bad thing. We're so used to widescreens now, but I don't think it's a bad thing. Google buys A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z.com.
For some reason.
Yeah, because it's not live now. If you go there, nothing happens.
Right. I just think they're crazy. That explains it.
Just nuts. Hey, you know, Larry Page had an extra $10 in his pocket. They are called Alphabet, after all.
Yeah.
And they had to use XYZ.com, which was kind of... Or no, what was it? ABC... What is it?
It's ABC...
Dot XYZ.
Dot XYZ. Yeah.
Which I think is a little easier to type than ABCDFGH.
I, for one, would prefer that they use this one, the long one. Nobody's going to go to Alphabet anyway. All the products and stuff like that are on the individual company websites. So why not? Just do it. It'll really make them stand out. That's my advice to you, Larry Page and Sergey Brin and all the rest of you.
Barry, when you say the whole alphabet, you don't sing it, do you?
I do not sing, period. So no.
I find myself going A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W.
The programming worked.
It did.
It does. And that's a great way to remember what comes first. It's like, well, does P come before? I don't remember, so I'm just going to sing this. So,
but my kids do sing it, yeah. So.
Yeah, of course. The domain was created in 1999 by somebody. Google updated on Wednesday. They took control of it, according to the Whois domain database.
The most boring possible explanation is they just didn't want anyone else to own it. And so they're buying it to
they wanted the headline Google buys Alphabet.
Yeah. Right. Plus they're cheap. Plus they lost google.com.
Why wouldn't you hook it up to something?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, Google. That's a strange oversight.
Do we know who owned it beforehand?
No, do you?
I don't know.
And why they owned it? Probably some Joe bought it and just, thought someday Google will name itself Alphabet and then I'll be able to sell this for millions.
Google does own more than 18,000 domains.
Wow. And they are a domain registrar themselves, so I doubt they actually had to buy it. They just took it.
They just took it. We're Google. We're Alphabet.
How does that work? Does ICANN get a cut? It must get a cut. How does that work? Because ICANN makes you a registrar. You have to be ICANN approved, otherwise you can register no domain names, but nobody will know. Presumably, the Google domain registry is at ICANN. Do they kick back to ICANN? They must kick like a buck back to ICANN.
Gotta be.
Otherwise, you'd be able to get them for $2, right?
Right. Exactly.
There's got to be some amount that ICANN gets.
Yeah, there's got to be a wholesale price. So,
Barry, did you know that when you got on this show? We'd be talking about dopey stuff like this.
Yeah, I've watched a couple times.
Oh, you knew. Oh, good. Okay. There was a guy who bought Google.com. He bought it for $12. He owned it for 1 minute before somebody noticed. A guy was a student and a former Google employee, Sanmay Ved. He bought Google.com due to an administrative issue at the search giant, according to CNBC. He was surprised, as one might be, to find the name up for sale. When he bought it, the $12 transaction went through, and ownership of the site was transferred.
And he had access to the webmaster tools for Google.com.
Are you kidding?
No.
Yeah, that's gold. He could have de-indexed the whole entire site.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
So now, recently, he's been given a bug bounty by Google's security team for revealing the weakness in the domain buying system.
Is it really a weakness? I mean, they released the name. It sounds like somebody just... The weakness was Joe in accounting, who's no longer there.
Yeah. He's been sent to the Russian front.
Programming flaw. So he had it only for about a minute before the purchase was canceled.
But what a minute. What a great minute. What a thrilling minute that must have been.
I own Google.com. And he did it through the Google domain service.
Yeah, I heard he actually donated the money that Google gave it back to some charity.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And Google doubled it because he did that. So it's a very happy ending here.
Oh. Yeah. Gosh, that would be fun. Just to own for a minute. I own Google. I'm the man who owned Google.com. Just for a minute.
Yeah.
Nobody used, apparently, the notification center in Chrome. So they took it out.
Yeah.
Actually, I found it very annoying because you'd go to a page, say The Verge, and it would say, would you like to allow notifications? Because you have to permit it. And you'd say that. And then in addition to the OS notifications you're getting, which are annoying enough, you'd be getting notifications from your browser.
Yeah. And then when you wanted notifications, they would happen while you were sleeping, and then you'd come back and they were gone. And so I just think this is one of those features that nobody really cared about, nobody noticed, nobody knew it was there. In fact, the majority of people listening to this and watching this show are like, there was a notification center? I mean, this is really under the radar. And
well, it's gone now. It'll be removed from Windows, Mac, and Linux in the next version of Chrome. However, you'll still have it in Chrome OS because the OS itself has no notification capabilities, so this is how it does.
Right.
Yeah, Barry?
Yeah, this is a very common thing. Google's constantly releasing new cool things, and then a year or two later, just saying nobody actually started using it, so we're gonna ditch it and try something else. So it's not unheard of from Google. They are constantly doing these types of things.
Don't you think it hurts them a little bit? Because, for instance, a developer, in order to use this, would have to put the code into the app saying use the notification center. And that's some work. And I think every time Google does one of these things and pulls back on it, I understand why shouldn't they prune useless branches. But I feel like developers might then be less likely to try something out the next time, like AMP.
Yeah. What's going to happen is that they're going to notifications are going to result in an error. And
now
so this
I have
is
to
going
fix
to be this little
code.
Problem. Yeah, exactly.
Is that true? Is there going to be an error now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's what Google says. And API events tied to the center will no longer fire. So it's I'm not really clear on exactly what the effect will be, but I guess we'll hear about this when it's really implemented. So, and Google does have a reputation for killing things that small numbers of people really love. And, of course, Google Reader being the biggest example of that. So everybody's really worried about everything Google does, and nobody really feels like they can jump in with all fours into things like this because it's just who knows what they're capable of. Who knows what these people are capable of?
Yeah, just today they also announced that the Ajax crawling schema for webmasters is no longer being recommended, and they're getting rid of it. So that's another example. And they're constantly doing these things, and they're constantly releasing new things like app indexing and the AMP thing you were talking about. So the question to me is always, should we go ahead and invest in these technologies? And I used to be the first. I used to be the first to implement everything Google said. And then when app indexing came out and AMP came out, I'm like, you know what? I'll just wait a little bit and see what happens.
What's the Ajax thing? Does that mean crawling Ajax pages?
Yeah, so Google has been getting much better at crawling, Ajax web pages over time. And they used to have this protocol back in 2009 to assist Google's crawlers, Googlebot, to crawl Ajax-related content. So you actually kind of had to hack your website, if it was built in Ajax, with different code to enable Google spiders to actually crawl through your Ajax website. Google said today that they are no longer supporting that proposal because they're good enough at indexing real Ajax websites without that hack. And they're telling people to remove that code and just build it the normal way.
Oh. Well, you're not going to get an error, are you?
No, you won't get an error. The question is, will
useless
your
code.
Site be indexed in the future?
Oh, nice. I used to see all the time errors from crawling JavaScript sites like you'd see in the site description would say, this site requires JavaScript things like that. But I don't see those much anymore. Is that because Google's gotten better at crawling sites that are not HTML?
Exactly. Google's much better at crawling sites that are not HTML. Plus, Google will sometimes, if you know, like you have a website that just has like a search box or something, kind of like the Google homepage, they might go ahead and actually enter content and submit to get behind the content to get in there so they can start crawling the site. So they're actually much better at detecting that stuff.
The reason I mention that is our website is all in Node.js. So if you view the source code on our site, it's not a lot of there's not a lot of content. It's all JavaScript. I mean, it gets rendered by the time actually when you view it, you're seeing HTML. But what Google might see when it crawls the site is probably not what you're going to see when you surf the site. So
yeah,
that's always been. In my mind, is that a cause for concern? But I guess not. Google's smart enough to.
It's not. If you
it
ever
renders it.
Go into the Google Search Console and you actually do a render of your website, I'm sure it actually looks like what you see it now. Googlebot's actually now able to see what the user sees for the most part, except for Flash and certain other technologies. But for the most part, they're able to see the actual website as a user would see it.
Well, that's interesting. Crawl errors. Yeah, so this is part of the Webmaster Tools. Is this the search appearance thing?
So go to crawl, I think.
Okay, crawl errors, crawl
fetches
stats.
Googlebot.
Fetches Google. So this will show me what a
click
page.
Click on the fetch and render button for your desktop, the big red button in the middle.
Fetch and render. And then
it's trying, and then once it goes, it's going to give you a little link to click on it.
Oh, I see. It says pending. Redirect. So this is, by the way, something we've been kind of banging on because, as you can see, Google has not been doing a good job of indexing our site. And it's because we moved to a new site, and I think we did something wrong. So stuff is not getting is getting redirected. Ay, ay, ay. I shouldn't probably be doing the yeah, see? Getting a redirect. Oh, I know why, because I did HTTP, not HTTPS. Ugh, what a mess.
Yeah, I'm trying to do
the right thing, because Google says make it HTTPS, and we'll index you better, but then it's a mess.
You have to go ahead and now verify your site on the HTTPS side with Google.
Ah, did you get that, Patrick? Verify on HTTPS. Barry from Search Engine Land says so. Maybe that might be what was wrong all along. We verified it obviously in the old days under HTTP. Now that we're HTTPS, we need to re-verify.
Right. The trick for webmasters when they're moving to HTTPS, if you do it for Google reasons or for security reasons, is you keep your HTTP profile there and you add your HTTPS profile into Google, and then you'll be able to see as Google starts to de-index the HTTP version, you'll see your index count in Google Search Console drastically go down, and at the same time, the HTTPS index count will drastically go up, and that's basically a tool for webmasters to follow that.
This web stuff's so complicated.
Yeah.
By the way, I see that we have some very nice ASCII art in our robots.txt.
Very nice.
Somebody spent a lot of time doing ASCII art in our robots.txt file. Wonder who did that. Is that you, Patrick? everybody who has a website should obviously be using google.com/webmasters, and those webmaster tools are fabulous. We've had, of course, the guy who for years was making those videos was Matt Cutts. Very, really great stuff. This is useful stuff. Barry, someday we should just do a show. You could explain what all this crap means to me.
Sure, no problem.
Look at all this. Holy cow. Google has filed paperwork with the Federal Aviation Administration for two new drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, and Gadget spotted these. There's one already, which is the Google Drone Delivery Project, Project Wing. But it turns out this is not for Project Wing. This is from Project Titan.
Not to be confused with Apple's car project called Project Titan.
Oh, you're right.
Oddly enough, they think they're a bunch of titans.
They are titans of industry.
They are titans of the tech industry. So this is their very high-flying solar-powered drone program that is
So it's for internet it's internet access.
Yes, exactly. Ah. And so part of this story
this competes with Loon.
This is an alternative to Loon and competes with Facebook's internet.org high-flying drone delivery system. But either way, it's really cool. And what's interesting about this in part is the fact that they are going to be testing in the U.S., which has been difficult for a lot of companies. They also have a great relationship with NASA. They manage Moffett Field right near their headquarters, which has a lot of opportunities to test drones indoors because the building is so large. It's a dirigible hangar.
An old dirigible hangar.
So this is the kind of news you hear about this, and you need to know more, but there are no details to be had other than the fact that it exists. There's two of them. On paper, they look identical. The FAA requires cryptic information about each of the drones, and there are two of them, and both have exactly the same numbers in every single field. So we don't know the difference between these two. They could be identical, and there's just two physical vehicles. Who knows? Who knows what's going on? It's kind of interesting. When I saw this story, Breck, I sort of started looking around at the job boards, you know, kind of people they're hiring, all the stuff they're doing around drones, and they're staffing up big time around this. They've got a New Mexico facility where they're doing a lot of drone development, literally under the radar, I guess you would say, or in this case, over the radar. Because they're so the altitude on these things is so high, but this is really exciting. And meanwhile, they are still working on delivery drones. So,
how cool would it be if they actually went ahead and made real time Google Street Views?
Yeah, that'd be cool. You know, and the funny thing is, if you look at the type of jobs that they're hiring for, they are building these aircraft completely from scratch. They're hiring materials people who are specialists in wing design. They're hiring, they're doing it all, and it's really fascinating that a company.
I wonder
like
why they wouldn't just buy off the shelf drones.
I don't know.
Maybe nothing like that exists, or just rent them from Facebook.
Yeah, it's not like the drone is the product. It's like a cell tower. You know, you're not going to.
It's kind of how Google works, though, isn't it?
Well, I think they get dissatisfied with the pace, and they can throw money and engineering talent at things. You know, for example, Project Loon's a perfect example. People have been doing ballooning and doing some of the things that they've been working on, the navigation of the balloons and so on, for a long, long time. But when Google got involved and really started pouring Google money at it, they were shattering records for how long a balloon could stay aloft. After decades of research facilities and all kinds of other people working on how do you keep balloons aloft for a long period of time. And so they really just accelerate the development of this because, of course, if they just waited for off-the-shelf parts to serve their particular needs, they would probably have to wait a lot longer.
Off-the-shelf drones.
Off-the-shelf drones. Exactly.
This is one, actually, that Barry says is going to affect him. I didn't know that you have a cloud service called Shul Cloud. Is this for synagogues?
Yeah, it's a synagogue management platform that's completely web-based.
How cool is that? So yeah. You say that this might the new we talked about this last week, the new safe harbor ruling or the overturn of the safe harbor ruling in the EU means that if you're a data provider in the EU, you have to adhere to laws of each of the individual countries. So that would impact you. So you do have operations outside of the U.S.
So I don't have physical operations, but I have customers that use. I have like synagogues in the U.K. and different EU regions that are paying a monthly service fee to use this service, and part of that includes us storing data, collecting financial data, donations, membership data, and so forth. And a lot of the EU. Mostly based in London, are saying, well, we need something from you now that the EU safe harbor ruling has been overturned. So what do I do? And then I'm pointing to Amazon, Salesforce, Google, and they're all using this type of model clauses. But it's much more complicated for me to implement that because I don't really have the infrastructure, the legal background, and so forth to do that. And my lawyer is not so aware of what to do. So it's not that easy for me to actually implement. So
you're not alone, apparently. Even the EU is not sure what it means.
Barry, what if you just moved to Europe? Would that solve this problem?
No.
And bring your servers with you?
I think some of the options are to have a representative based in Europe, which makes it easier.
Yeah.
But I still think it doesn't solve. I don't know. Honestly, I'm just, I got an email from three of the synagogues in London area and saying, you know, what do we do now? I'm like, just trust us. We're okay. And they're like, no, it's not good enough. So I'm figuring out what to do right now.
Huh. Interesting problem.
Apparently there's a debate even within the EU about what it means. On one, this is from an article at Data Center Knowledge. There are two schools of thought. One school of thought is that Safe Harbor is dead, and that means that there's no protection for overseas data center operators like you, Barry. You just have to adhere to the laws of the various countries you're in. The other, and according to David Snead, who's the co-founder and attorney with the Internet Infrastructure Coalition, which is a U.S. kind of industry group that includes Google, Amazon, and Equinix, says that he thinks that it's the European Union and the European Commission in particular have to just figure out how to interpret it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That there needs to be some new
right
policy. So meanwhile, Barry and people like him just don't know what to do. It's unrealistic to think, Snead says, that all transatlantic data is going to have to stop as a result of this decision. That certainly would be an impact that the EU would not like.
Yeah.
The European Commission is likely to figure out a way to accommodate it, and the U.S. as well. So in other words, he's saying, and he's probably right, there's no need to panic. What are you going to do, Barry?
Panic?
I asked my clients, my synagogue clients there, to just hold off. Give me a couple months to
really
see what they're doing. And we'll figure it out.
So you're not going to allow overseas customers?
Well, they're just signing up. I'm not stopping them from signing up. I just
they
don't
can't
know
use
if I'm,
it.
They could use it. I think it leaves the liability on them versus on me. And they don't want that, I believe. I could be completely wrong. But according to New York law, I don't have to do anything until the end of 2016. If they want to sign up, I'm not liable for anything.
Oh, good. Of course, I'm sure the EU does not recognize New York law.
I know. But.
So you're good luck. Have fun. And you thought it was a good idea. Just a little business on the side.
Exactly.
Actually, it's really cool. When did you start that?
We started this about 3.5 years ago, almost 4 years ago, just for my own synagogue. And then all the other synagogues in the area started wanting it. And now we have close to 400 synagogues using it across the world. It's pretty insane.
And what does it manage?
It's basically, you know, when you have members sign up to your synagogue, they get dues. They get like, you know, monthly dues, and they get, you know, different honors they give to the shul, and they pay different things, and they get reminded about family birthdays and death notices.
Neat.
And
right.
Member, and it's basically
don't forget
like
to buy
business.
Your Rosh Hashanah tickets, things like that.
Exactly. High holiday, Rosh Hashanah
very,
tickets. All
very
that.
Important. Get those tickets early. That's cool. That's a really interesting. And you wrote it just kind of as a kind of service for your own temple.
Yeah, like most software companies start, it's like, hey, you
scratched your own itch.
There's a need for it. Yeah. You built it, and it's filling a need.
What's it written in?
It's mostly it's PHP MySQL, and it's on Amazon. It's AWS service.
AWS, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think AWS, I mean, that would be in Amazon's interest, wouldn't it, as mm-hmm. As a provider of these services, as a billion-dollar business we now know for Amazon?
Yeah.
It would be smart of them to act on behalf of all their customers and kind of go to the EU and say, okay, we got all these guys doing this.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Right. So I think Amazon has their thing directly with, but I don't think it covers everything right. for the provider. So I would sign up. I would pay $1,000+ per whatever it costs to have a third party verify whatever I need to verify and confirm that I'm compliant, like you have with PCI, HIPAA,
right?
All these verification services, I would pay for that. So
right, and we hope that's all that would be required. Although part of the problem is that, for instance, Germany has much more draconian laws than say England, and I presume this means you'd have to be, I don't know, compliant with each country. Amazon has obtained approval from the EU data protection authorities for an agreement and model clauses, which says
allows it to continue to serve its European customers. So it says, with our EU-approved data protection agreement and model clauses, AWS customers can continue to run their global operations using AWS in full compliance with EU law. That's what,
right,
Barry, I'd say, hey, I'm cool. I got AWS behind me.
I've said that to them, and they said,
no,
we're cool with the AWS side, but we need to be cool also managing our data.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know. It's complicated.
This is the whole problem with this entire fiasco, which is that instead of working toward an alternative for safe harbor, they simply threw a monkey wrench in it, and everybody's confused. Nobody, including Amazon, really knows what is going to happen here. And Barry's a perfect example of what the real problem is. Barry himself is willing to, has been around long enough to where he knows, I think this is going to be fine. But he's got customers who are pushing back and saying, well, we need assurances. We need more than just your sunny optimism. And there are none to be had. There's no place where you can go and be assured that this is what's going to happen. Nobody knows. It's a really, really bogus situation that Europe has created here.
Let's take a break. We got more to talk about. Barry Schwartz is here from Search Engine Land.
The land of search engines.
What do you cover, Barry? I see your byline all the time. Is there a particular beat you cover there?
Yeah, I cover most of the organic search stuff, SEO, Webmaster, and local search.
In fact,
so most of the geeky stuff.
In fact, you have a big article on SearchCap right on the front page. And Google has discontinued support for Ajax crawling. We just talked about that. So this is right up your alley. Well, I'm glad you're with us. It's nice to meet you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mike Elgin also here. We just pull him across the room.
Yep. I have a rolling chair. We'll just roll it across.
Pull that rope.
The staff. Yeah. It's very convenient.
And so good to have you. He's the news director here, of course, and runs Tech News Tonight. I'm sorry, Tech News Today.
Yes.
Every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC on twit.tv.
Where you will also occasionally find Barry as a guest.
Yes. I don't think there's anybody in the tech news business who hasn't been a guest.
Oh, yes.
Dude, how many a day? How many editors a day do you have?
Oh, it ranges from one to five.
I've seen sometimes a big number of them.
Yeah, we probably average 15 a week.
Wow.
Something like that, yeah. And it's not all of them. It's just the good ones. We don't have the pickup artists. We don't have the people who are lagging. We have the bleeding edge people like Barry who are breaking news and finding things out. And
that's what you want. You want to watch a news show with the authoritative sources, the reporters who are covering the story.
Yeah.
Is that what they call them? Pickup artists.
Pickup artists.
Those are the blogs that just take somebody else's story, rewrite it.
Exactly.
I hate it when I follow a link and I see that.
You know, and this is part of what we do on Tech News Today is we know the difference between who broke the story and who didn't. And we get the person who broke the story on the show to talk about how they broke it. And there's always content you won't read in their articles.
I try to do that when we're talking about something. Follow the link. Because at some point they'll always, I hope, always credit the original source.
Yep.
I like to follow that all the way down to the original source.
Yeah. Yep.
Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're in the unenviable position of having to hire people for your business, think of it this way. What is a challenge is also a huge opportunity. Those people make your business. That's what a company is. It's made up of the people who work there, and your company can succeed or fail based on the hires you are going to make today. That's why it's so important to go to the right places to find the right people. And sometimes that means kissing a lot of toads to find that prince or princess. ZipRecruiter, this is their new tagline. I've just invented it. Makes it easier to kiss a lot of toads. 100+ job boards with a single click of the mouse. I mean, including all the social networks like Twitter and Facebook and Craigslist. It'll give you access not only to all the people on those job boards, but they have 6 million current resumes in their database. So within a day of you posting, you will start getting lots of candidates. Now, here's the best part. You're not going to get them calling your phone or sending you email direct. They'll all filter into ZipRecruiter's trademark interface. This interface is great because it gives you a chance to very quickly, and since you're going to get hundreds of applicants, very quickly screen them so you get rid of anybody who doesn't fit and rate them and then hire the right person, in a day or two, you're going to have the best candidate for that job you've ever seen. Because it's very easy to separate the wheat from the chaff, the toads from the princes. It's a great system. No wonder more than 400,000 businesses, including Twit, have used ZipRecruiter to hire. You can do it, too. We got an email from Dan. He was very happy. He sent us an email. This is the quote. The hardest part about running a business when you need to hire is you have to spend extra time recruiting exactly when you're short-staffed, when you have the least time to spend. But with ZipRecruiter, I've gotten quality candidates within 24 hours of posting a job. ZipRecruiter's website makes this process so much faster by letting me manage candidates in one place. That's the secret sauce here. Not only do you reach out to more people and more places and more candidates, not only do you get more people and more candidates for that job, but you have an easy way to manage all those applicants, and that's fantastic. Find the right person fast. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twig. You'll get a 4-day free trial. That's enough, really, to hire that person you need today. ZipRecruiter.com/twig. And we thank them so much for their support of This Week in Google. Barry Schwartz from Search Engine Land, Mike Elgin from Twit, myself. We're talking about the week's Google News. Jeff Jarvis is on assignment. He's probably on a plane, actually. This is a story from Search Engine Land I found interesting. More than half of Google's searches are on mobile now. Half of Google searches happen on mobile.
You knew it was going to happen.
Well, you know, more than half of our visitors to our website are mobile. I'm sure that's true of Search Engine Land, too.
Right.
But search is a little different because I don't know about how you use mobile, but I don't go to the Google webpage and type in a search on mobile.
Well, you know, it's an interesting fact because, of course, a huge number of access of content on the web is through apps.
Right.
So there's apps over here, and then there's people using browsers on their mobile devices over there, and they're different. And this is saying that among all the browsers, desktop and mobile, now more than half are on mobile. So the vast majority of access of internet usage is on mobile devices.
Well, see, that's what that tells me. If half our searches are on mobile, that means like 90% of computing is on mobile, right? It'd have to be.
Because and people are using their phone. Yes, and there's also an age differentiation on this. The younger people are, the more likely they are to use their mobile device for everything. And the geezers are the ones using desktop computing for everything, and then there's this spectrum between the two. But yes, people are still opening browsers on the mobile devices
in that window.
And typing, I'm searching for this.
God, it seems like such a pain in the butt.
Yeah,
it's fun to browse on a mobile keyboard and all that.
Yeah.
What's interesting, also, these stats come from ComScore, is that searches are not down on desktop. The desktop searches continue to be strong. It's just that mobile has ramped up so much.
We've outsourced our brains and to the internet, and we just don't even have to know anything anymore.
I bet you a lot of the searches are OK Google or Hey Siri, right? I bet you that's, I mean, because typing is such a pain in the butt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do we know how many of these are voice driven and how many are typed in? Probably not.
No, they haven't shared much about what's voice driven, what's not, if it's Google Now on Tap and all these other things that drive search per se, and they might not be direct searches, but we don't know if it's typed. I assume it includes both typed searches on mobile as well as voice searches, and maybe also native searches, you know, searching for apps and searching the content within apps using app indexing. So it could be a lot.
Well, you make an interesting point. Now on Tap is just starting to roll out with Marshmallow with Android 6. That's going to double the number as soon as that becomes widespread immediately, because you'll be using it's pretty cool. I the only Marshmallow I've been able to use is Jason's Nexus 7, which he sideloaded Marshmallow onto it. And it's so cool. You're on anything, any web page, and you just tap to select a word or an idea or whatever, and you get these results. And I think you're going to see more mobile search because of that. Those guys at Google are smart. They figured that out, huh?
Plus, more people are going to be using, Siri and Google Now and Cortana and Alexa. And when they, half the time when people are asking for arbitrary information, that's going through a search engine as well, whether it's Bing or Google's knowledge base, whatever it is. And I think that's another trend in that direction. So it's really kind of a fascinating fact that people are doing this kind of behavior, and it's also raises the question of what's a mobile device. So a smartphone
is a tablet,
device.
A mobile device? Is that an iPad?
Yeah, you know, a 7-inch tablet, is that a mobile device?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm thinking it is. Is a Microsoft Surface Book a mobile device?
No.
Okay,
is a Surface Pro.
But is an iPad?
I'd say no.
Is an iPad Pro? That's iOS.
Mark Zuckerberg famously said.
Well, he said
it's not.
But he would have to admit that it's a portable device. So you carry it around the house was his idea.
Barry, do they? How do they break this down? Comscore must have a rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Right?
So I don't know if they're breaking this figure down by tablet searches, but in terms of Google's definition of what's a tablet, what's not, it depends. I would think on some cases, does the device have apps on it? And then those are mobile apps. So maybe it's a mobile device. But on the other end, when it comes to building a mobile-friendly website, according to Google's webmaster guidelines, a desktop version of your site rendering on a tablet is perfectly fine. There's no problem with that. But a desktop version rendering on a mobile device, like a phone type of device, is not acceptable. It's not mobile-friendly.
Huh. Is six so inches the cutoff? What's the size cutoff?
They didn't really specify what the cutoff is. So
yeah. I mean,
not clear.
So this is a Nexus 6. That's 6 inches. A Nexus 7 is one. It's a little bit bigger. Is that the cutoff right there? I mean, that's a weird place to put it.
Maybe if it gets phone calls or not. Maybe that's the cutoff.
Maybe that's it. Okay.
But why would that matter for data? It's a muddled thing to define. It's clear on the iOS platform. You have iOS and you have OS 10. One is a mobile and the other isn't.
Right.
That's one way to do it. You go over to Google and it's less clear. Of course, everything on Android could theoretically, but now we have the Pixel C. So is that like a desktop computer?
I'm going to say anything that doesn't have an attached keyboard.
It's tough.
I'm going to say if there's not an attached keyboard, that's mobile. So a Surface Book would not be mobile.
So when I use a keyboard with my phone?
But that's not attached.
I see.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So if it's super glued on there.
That's not attached. It's just dumb. You had an Arsenal article in Search Engine Land in which you talked about, and I thought this might be telling. Despite the growth in apps, search remains strong. Google search in mobile browsers is big. This comes from a Morgan Stanley report based on the Comscore data. But Google search within the Google app is even bigger. In fact, Google search is the fourth most popular app overall in the U.S. And that would include OK Google, right? Mm-hmm. That would include voice search because that goes through that app.
Yeah.
At least on iOS, it goes through that app. I don't know what it does on Android. I guess it doesn't go through any apps.
And all
fourth
of this
most popular app.
Yeah, and all of this raises another interesting question, which is the number one app by far
Facebook.
Is Facebook.
Yeah,
and Facebook is constructing an alternative to the entire internet. They've recently come out with their own shopping site, so they're going after Amazon.
They've reinvented AOL, is what they've done.
Exactly what they've done. So you think of an alternative reality, an alternative internet, and when you search on Facebook, good luck finding anything, but eventually I think they'll have search. Is that a
funny
search?
Funny, because that whole knowledge graph or whatever they call it, the social search, that was a big deal when they released it.
But where is it?
Does anybody use it? I use it to search for a person's name.
Search for the content of something in a post on Facebook,
right.
And you will find literally nothing.
Nothing.
It's bizarre that this doesn't bother anybody.
Yeah.
You can't search it.
You can't search
and
it.
And again, they're taking over the world. If you look at the number of users on Facebook, on Instagram, on WhatsApp, on everything that Facebook has on their own Messenger app, I mean, that's the vast majority of users online.
The top 25 mobile apps by unique visitors, this is from Comscore, June 2015, plus year-to-year, year-over-year growth. So Facebook is 125, I'm assuming this is million, maybe it's billion, I don't know, 125,727,000, but 9% year-over-year growth. You know who's growing faster? Facebook Messenger, 144%, but you combine those two, it's completely dominant. YouTube's in the middle with 18% year-over-year growth. Google Search is the fourth, as we mentioned, with 16%. Then Google Play, Google Maps, Pandora, of all things. Gmail, Instagram, also a Facebook property. Apple Music, which is pretty big given that it's only on iOS. Apple Maps.
Pinterest is growing. Meanwhile, Twitter and Snapchat are laying people off.
Yeah.
Because
Snapchat's laying people off?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they stopped.
Oh, man, I was bullish on Snapchat.
Snapchat itself is doing pretty well, but they launched into creating original content, and this week they decided they're getting out of the. They're not going to create any.
So the people they're laying off are the people,
exactly.
The editorial staff.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, but you know what? They're great. I think they're still a very strong platform.
Yeah, but again, they're in a different universe, a different stratosphere than that's the wrong term. But they're in a whole different level than Facebook. Facebook is, you know, is the equivalent of many, many Snapchats in terms of users.
Yeah, of course. Should Facebook continue to attempt to acquire
Snapchat?
You know what I think is interesting is now the executive chairman over at Twitter is Omid.
Yeah,
you say his name.
I will, and just you got to give me a second.
He's a Google employee.
Yeah, a longtime Google guy.
Khordestani, how you pronounce
Khordestani.
It.
That's right.
He is actually a former Google. Oh, so he's not still at Google.
No.
Oh, okay. See, I was drawing a lot of conclusions from that. Like maybe this was the wedge, the camel's nose under the tent of Google taking over Twitter, which I still think would be a smart thing to do, wouldn't it?
He was employee number 11 at Google.
Yeah, he's very well respected at Google. He would be the guy. He was the chief business officer from August 2014 to August. Oh, till the company reorganized under Alphabet, and he's now a senior advisor. So you know what? Hmm. He's in that special Google camp of, we don't have a job for you, but please continue to accept this check.
Yeah.
And if you think of anything good,
Big Head on the roof.
He is the mole. He is the guy on the Twitter board now
that
begins the conversations of, I think this is a sign Google wants to acquire
Twitter. What would Google, I mean, of course, I'm sure we've had this conversation many times, but what benefit could Google bring to Twitter other than truckloads of cash?
It's not what benefit Google could bring to Twitter. It's what benefit Twitter could bring to Google. It's it's all those social signals.
Yeah.
Don't you think, Barry, that helps a lot with search? Is that one of the things that's missing at Google? That's why they created Google Plus.
Right. So Google's talked about this a lot in terms of social signals. Matt Cutts has talked about it. Since then, other Googlers have talked about it. And Google's afraid to use Twitter signals because remember when they turned off the fire hose?
Yeah. But they've remade that deal. That deal was remade.
They remade the deal, but they don't want to use that for ranking purposes because they're afraid they're going to turn it off again and their ranking algorithm will break.
That's why you buy it. You can't turn, right? They own it. They can't turn it off. So we accept that Google wants those signals. They really want those signals, right?
They also say it's very, very easy to manipulate, although links are very easy to manipulate. So, favoriting something, retweeting something, I don't know, paying a very high profile Twitter personality to tweet out a link and share stuff. I don't know.
I may be reading too much into this, but the fact that this guy is now executive chairman at Twitter.
Yeah.
Just feels to me like Larry called him and said, look, we're not going to have anything for you after Alphabet.
Right.
We would really like to. It feels like it's like a John le Carré novel.
Right.
Mr. Smiley, you're on the beach. Go ahead. Enjoy your retirement. And oh, by the way, if you should have any free time, we got a little job for you.
Yeah. Now, Khordestani, he's a really, really deep Google guy. He was employee number 11.
Yeah.
In 1999,
he's been all over the place. Yeah. Came from
he's Iranian. He moved to the U.S. I think in 1979 or something.
But where did he work? He worked at a bunch of big companies. He was at Netscape.
Yeah,
as a vice president, he was at Hewlett Packard. That could be good or bad depending on when he was at Hewlett Packard. Chief business officer at Google. That's the guy who makes biz deals, right? Yep. Isn't that the guy?
Yeah.
He's the guy.
They probably fell in love with a guy when he was going over to make business deals with, from Google. Hi, I'm from Google. I want to talk business deals.
Jack Dorsey says he tweeted, of course, because
that's right.
Why would you have a press release or an interview or anything? He says, a great chairperson is the first step toward continuing to make our board one of the best in the world and purpose-built to serve Twitter. By the way, the first thing he did, of course, was get rid of Dick Costolo, the former CEO. He's still got Ev Williams breathing down his neck, the other founder.
Right, he's next.
I bet you Ev's next.
Yeah.
Omid is a proven and experienced leader who will directly help and coach me and our leadership and help us recruit the best folks to Twitter. Well, that's for sure.
Yep.
Maybe he left Google because he was upset at how much money that Google spent on the ABCDEFG.com domain.
You got to say the whole thing if you're going to say it. ABCDEFGHIJKLMNOPQRSTUVWXYZ.com.
And sometimes you got to ask why. Sometimes why. So one of the interesting things about him is he grew up in Tehran, Iran, and he went to an Italian Catholic school in Iran, moved to San Jose at the age of 14, and graduated from San Jose State and worked at HP. Huh.
And Netscape, where he was there kind of at the big growth spurt of Netscape after their IPO.
Yep.
He also, before then, he worked at Go. Remember Go Corp? Yeah. Are you've been around long enough?
Yes, I do remember.
It was a pen-based operating system, right?
It was. Yes.
Or did they make hardware? I can't remember if they made hardware.
No, I think that was it was going to be an alternative. Now, one of the things about Cordestani that's a little surprising, you think, oh, who is this guy? He's a former Google employee. He's probably, you know, upper middle class, lives in Palo Alto. He's worth $2 billion. The guy is a billionaire.
The job.
Yeah.
But, of course, a guy like that, the challenge posed by Twitter would be of an interest. It's the same reason that Marissa Meyer would move to run Yahoo. It's, what a challenge, right?
Exactly.
How's that working out for her?
I don't know. What do you think? We haven't talked about Marissa in ages. What's going on over at Yahoo? Ever since Kara Swisher got acquired by Vox, not a thing. We got to get Kara in here.
If she looked back at where it would be today, like in hindsight, I probably think she probably would not have done that.
No.
Really? Like she'd be better off at Google?
Maybe. Yahoo's a hard company to turn around, and I don't think if she looked at her progress as of today that she would think, I turned the company around.
Nope. Can't say that.
I think that what's interesting about it is not whether Marissa Meyer is great, has failed or isn't great enough to turn Yahoo around. I think what's interesting at this point is we have to confront the probability that Yahoo is unsalvageable. That it can't, first of all, nobody knows what it is. Nobody knows what its function or purpose is. Nobody is able to impose a purpose or function on this company after the fact. I just think that I think it should be stripped for parts and sold off and just dismantled, and everybody should go home or something like that. I think that Marissa Meyer has done a perfectly good job, as good as anybody could do. And it's just something that can't be done.
She didn't. It may be that it was a ship that couldn't be turned.
Yeah.
Or maybe she wasn't the captain to turn it.
Turn it where? It's like, what is it? It was a portal.
Right.
You know, and then in addition to that, they bought a gazillion little semi-related companies.
It's a content play.
Yeah. So
she couldn't decide, though, could she, whether it should be a content company or a services company. She kind of bet on both. People expected her to choose one or the other.
But again, once you choose one or the other, once you decide, oh, from now on, we're going to be Tumblr. That's our big play, and everything else we're going to get rid of. You're stripping it for parts. And I think that's exactly what should happen. And by the way, Tumblr is awesome. Tumblr is a great service that is doing okay. But again, once you sort of have it inside of the Yahoo umbrella, it's kind of a turd.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like.
Yeah, no, you're right. It could be Squarespace as a standalone.
Yes.
Or WordPress.com. Instead, it's a division of Yahoo.
I really think that they need to go in 50 different directions. Or maybe become Alphabet and just have independently run companies.
She got a free pass for a while because they were living on the Baidu cash.
Yeah.
But then they spun that off. Yeah. And now the chickens come home.
Yeah.
Didn't they take a mobile approach? Wasn't that like, we're doing mobile, we're going to do mobile right across
a little bit verticals. Remember they updated the Flickr app, it was really nice. But remember, look at the Yahoo stock thing was in the top 10 of the most used apps for reasons I don't fully understand,
but there's no reason for a single company to own these different individual properties. There's no reason. I don't understand, other than, you know, if you sell ads and you have ad network, but so what? And the ad network itself should be a separate thing. Yeah. So I don't know.
So here's one thing she's up to. She and Mark Pincus just invested in a startup that makes brain drugs.
They're going to need them. Like what's that show? Limitless. Have you seen this?
Yeah, you take a pill and you're suddenly
It's a great show. Yeah, it's a great show.
You know, that's Flowers for Algernon.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. And then you die.
The startup which was founded, is called First of all, do not name your startup Neutrobox, N-O-O-T-R-O-B-O-X, if you want anybody to say it right. Apparently, they make nootropics, which are cognitive performance supplements or smart or brain drugs.
Way better than old tropics.
Like coffee without the jitters. And it, I guess one of these guys had worked for Meyer. She actually hired him at Google, so maybe that's maybe it's just a personal thing. She's apparently doing some angel investing. They're going to make four supplements, Rise, Sprint, Yawn, and a new gummy coffee replacement called Go Cubes. How could they fail? How could they fail? This is a guaranteed. I'll have some Yawn. And do you have any of those Go Cubes?
Yawn sounds like a like a.
What
like
would you want Yawn for? Go to sleep, right?
Yeah. It's just so random. It's just so
it's
random.
Simple, I mean, clean packaging. I shouldn't say anything because maybe there'll be an advertiser next month.
Yeah.
And monthly subscriber auction. Is Nootropox going to? No, okay. The clean packaging and monthly subscription option. Well, remember, I don't know if you remember, when we first started, you before your time, Mike, we had this company called Brain Tonic. Remember this? They came by and they said, we'll give you all the brain tonic you want as long as you just drink it on the air once in a while. It was supposed to be make you smart.
Yeah.
But so it made me sleepy. Did it make you sleepy, Jason?
I don't remember it making me much of anything. It
tasted like grapefruit.
Well, you know, sleeping more makes you smart.
I would drink. Now, we probably shouldn't have had four or five cans. But I would drink it, and then I would get loopy. So it definitely had a maybe.
It's doing something.
It's doing something.
So we'll see what Yawn does. Oh, man.
Jerry Kaplan, Robert Carr, Kevin Doran founded Go Corp in 1987 to create portable computers, an operating system, and software with a pen-based user interface.
Oh, they did have devices.
Omid Kordestani, former senior VP of global business at Google, began his startup career with Go Corporation. Bill Campbell, who's chairman at Intuit, also was there. Randy Commissar, who became CEO of LucasArts, was there. And VP Marketing Mike Homer, who became VP Marketing at Netscape. And I guess that's probably how Omid got over at Netscape during their IPO. Yeah, the PenPoint OS, it ran, remember this, on AT&T's EO personal communicator.
Yes. Oh, God.
I think we have an EO in the basement. I'm pretty sure we do. I'm pretty sure we do.
That was going to be the future of something.
It was the future of something. The EO. AT&T pulled out. Co-founder Jerry Kaplan says, in its lifetime, Go created generated no meaningful sales. And there it is.
Yeah.
Where did you find that? Computers.net.
Yeah, it was a big. So imagine a black and white sort of greenish device with a 2-inch bezel and 4 inches thick with like giant handles on the side.
It had ears. I vividly remember this. Yeah. $2,000, and it looks like it looks very much like a Newton, doesn't it?
Yeah,
that's the Newton. Yeah. That looks like the Newton OS on there.
And look, there's your calendar. Yeah, those are the days.
I still have an Apple Newton. In the other room.
I have several in the other room. I don't know why.
But you know what was bleeding edge about it, Leo? What? It was wireless.
Yeah.
Wireless.
This was an example of a great idea, of an idea whose time had not come.
Yes.
Because the technology wasn't there yet.
Right.
And that's all. And if it weren't for these, probably...
The Palm Pilot wouldn't have come about.
Yeah, we wouldn't have had the Newton. We wouldn't have had the Palm Pilot. We wouldn't have had the iPhone. So, that's right. You know, it all kind of works its way up. But I feel sorry for the people who bought the EO.
Yeah. It's a collector's item now, though.
Look at the...
has an antenna. Giant.
Looks
phone.
Like a phone on there, yeah. Too.
You could send a fax from the beach.
That's why AT&T was in it, of course.
Yeah.
The ears were put there by Frog Design. They said this will differentiate it from everything else.
Because AT&T said no to the flippers they wanted to put there.
No flippers. We just want ears. $2,000.
It's incredible.
I probably bought one. That's what's really sad.
I remember spending an enormous amount on mobile devices back in that era.
I think you, like me, believed that this was the future.
Right. I bought a an HP Omnibook for $3,000.
I had an Omnibook. That was the one where the mouse was attached. Well, you press a button, it would go boing, and it had an arm that went back into the machine.
That was literally the best mobile device ever created. So this was made by the calculator. You're talking about the first one. They ruined it by turning it into a regular laptop over time. But the first one had a little popsicle stick thing, the mouse control. But it ran on AA batteries. Remember that?
Yes.
It had rechargeable batteries, but you could pop those out, put in AA batteries. It had an incredible keyboard. Again, it was from the calculator division, so it was super high quality. And it had 12-hour battery life in an era when, 2 hours was normal.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's that mouse with the arm.
I used to love that device. And you would push it down, and it would go into the laptop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you'd close it, and that was a great.
Not so great if you're a lefty. But otherwise,
well, I mean, you can have re-education camps for people who are left-handed. That's not a problem.
I had one as well. Yeah. I remember the Omnibook very well.
But even this version, which wasn't even in color. Oh, and the other thing that was weird about it is it had Windows and Office in ROM. Remember that?
Yeah, it was.
So
it
only had 2 megabytes of RAM.
Well, a lot of these, that's how they worked.
Because the applications executed in ROM. They said, oh, we'll be updating these and just buy a new ROM. It's the future. And then they never did.
Wow. Mike and I are old farts, Barry.
Yes.
Just ignore us.
Old.
Someday we'll be sitting on the porch going, you remember the Omnibook? whatever happened to that Marisha? What was her name? Whatever happened to her? Oh, she got super smart and moved to Saturn. Let's take a break. Yeah, so Yahoo Stocks is bigger than Twitter in application use. It's grown 10%. It is not in the top 10, but it's in the top 15, right under Apple Maps.
But, the thing is that just to compare Yahoo
Snapchat
with Twitter you can compare Tumblr, which is one tiny bit of Yahoo, with Twitter. They should be
I don't see Tumblr on this list at all.
I'm not sure they're considered a social network.
No, this is apps.
Those are just
mobile
sites.
Apps. No, they're not even sites. These are the top 25 mobile apps. Not even the top 25.
Yeah, mobile app. I don't think people use Tumblr in the mobile app so much. But Tumblr has a significant, large, but...
That means it's history if you don't use a mobile app.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Snapchat's not very high. It's just above Google Plus. Yeah. Are you still... Well, I'm going to save it for that.
Yeah,
for the
save
break.
It.
You still using that thing? Our show today brought to you by Where's My Harry's? Where's my razor? Give me a razor. Barry, it's not too late to shave that beard. Yeah. All you got to do is get a little Harry's and you'll get a little less hairy. Harry, I don't think that's their slogan. Harry, I'm good at making up bad slogans. That's really one of my fortes. This is the Harry's razor. So the idea is, these guys said, we want to this is what everybody now is. If you're a hot young thing coming out of school and you want to do a startup, you say, what is ripe for disruption?
Yep.
What industry begs to be reinvented on the internet? And, of course, it doesn't take long. You go to the grocery store and you look at the razor blades under lock and key, and I think a light could go off and you could say, you know what? These are so expensive that they lock them up. In the drugstore, surely you can make these for less. So the guys at Harry's did a little research. They had some experience. Jeff, one of them, started Warby Parker. So they had a little experience, and they had a little venture funding. Actually, I think they went to the venture funders, and they said, look, I got an idea. We can do a direct-to-you business in razors and razor blades, but there's one little catch. We've got to buy the factory.
Oh, yeah? Where's the factory?
It's in Germany. Well, how much? It's a lot. But once we own it, we will own one of only two places in the world that can make these blades. Yeah. And we can make them to our specification for precision, for quality. And then because we make them, we can sell them for less. And that's exactly what Harry's does. They engineer them for sharpness, for high performance. They ship them for free to your door. And because they make and ship their own blades, Harry's can charge you a lot less, like half as much as that Gillette Fusion locked up in the drugstore. Start with the kit because you're going to need the handle. Go to harrys.com. You can get the Truman, which is an amazing deal for $15, although I'll tell you how you can save even more. Or I have in my hands the Winston. This is what I use at home because I am an upscale kind of guy, $25. You get the rate. In both cases, you get the handle. This, the Winston is a nice metal handle, which you can get engraved and everything. Plus three blades. This is all for, well, you'll as little as $10. Plus three blades. Plus you get the travel cover, which I know people laugh when I say this is my favorite part. But I, this way you don't cut your fingers when you reach into your shaving kit. And then you choose from the Harry's shaving foam gel or the Harry's cream. As little as $10 when you get the Truman kit and use our discount. That's an amazing deal. Then sign up for the monthly resupply or, you know, bi-monthly or quarterly, whatever it is you want. You can get more shaving cream. You can get more blades at a very, very good price shipped directly to you for free. No cost for the shipping. They also have an aftershave moisturizer that protects and hydrates and smells fantastic. They have, this is actually a good place to go if you've got a dad or a grad or, you know, you want to gift somebody in your life. This is a really welcome gift for men. They even have this little stand, this cube that you can put your blade in and get engraved with dad's name. I just feel like this is a really half the price and the best quality, better than what you're getting in the store. HARRYS.com. And here's the deal. Use the offer code TWIG. Let them know you heard about it on This Week in Google. And we'll give you $5 off your first order. That means that Truman kit is $10. You don't have to tell dad that when you give it to him. Harrys.com, offer code TWIG. Save by $5 off and let them know you heard about it on This Week in Google. We thank them for their support and for keeping us smooth. So they took apart the On Hub. Did you buy an On Hub when that?
I did not.
I bought it and canceled it.
Yeah,
I got
good
one.
Call.
Did you get one? Because I read Ron Amadio's review on Ars Technica, and he said this thing is not fast. It's not. It's just a router. What do you think?
Yeah, Barry? No, it's not so special at all.
Yeah, and yeah, I needed the something range. Special.
Yeah, I have a pretty tall house, and it didn't. It doesn't reach the whole thing. I was hoping that this would cover all the range. Yeah. I have three zones. Like, I think I'll get rid of two of my zones and just keep one zone.
Yep.
I have all, now I have like four zones because of the hot.
It's
hot.
Worse than what you had. I just read a really good article about Brian X. Chen in the New York Times. I think it was last Sunday. He said, if your router is more than 3 years old, it's time to get a new router.
Yeah. Yep.
And I had been using the Apple AirPort Extreme, which I'm sorry, I had been recommending for years. It was an expensive $180 router.
Yeah.
But
that's why they call it the Extreme. It was the price. It was a reference to the price.
I thought it was the best router out there, but I was having all sorts of trouble. It kept dropping. And I went out and I bought a very nice Asus. It was much more expensive. It was over $200.
Is that the one with the claws? And
yeah, it looks like a spider.
Yeah.
It's got six antennas. It's three bands. The AC3200. It's not that new one that they showed.
Yeah.
But at IFA, that's not
out. That's
yet.
Not out yet, right?
But this is the top of the line Asus. I got it because they use a version of DDWRT in the firmware. You can easily hack it. In fact, I put Merlin on it immediately to turn off the bright lights on the front.
And
I just love it. I mean, it's amazing. In fact, I asked Lisa today, this morning, we've had it for a month. I said, how's the Wi-Fi been? Has it dropped late? Nope. Everything working? Oh, yeah. She says so much faster than what I thought was the premium router out there. So I actually canceled the OnHub. Because I saw Ron's review and I thought, no, I need something fast. Turns out, Brian Whitman writing for Android Police.
Another frequent tech news today.
Guys. Yeah, actually, this is actually quoting the exploiteers, exploite.rs. They tore it down and rooted it. And it turns out the OnHub is basically a Chromebook in disguise. There's even a hidden switch, just like on the old Chromebooks, that lets you put it in developer mode.
Here's the thing that I'm confused about. So, when this came out, when they were talking about it before the Ron Amadios of the world got their hands on this thing.
They were pissed, by the way, about Ron Amadios' review.
I'm sure they were.
Yeah, but it was true.
But the spiel that they gave us was, this is a new kind of router. This is unlike anything. This is for the Internet of Things, home automation, and all the rest. Okay, so that's Exhibit A. And then it comes out and it's like, it's a router. And it's not that great.
Oh, they said it's got 13 antennas and it tunes the antenna.
Exactly.
And then by the way, made by TP-Link for Google.
Yeah.
TP-Link's not a bad manufacturer. In fact, in the Wirecutter, they recommend as their favorite router for under $100, the TP-Link Archer C7.
Yeah.
So it's not that it's a bad company, but I think Google specs were very limited. It turns out when they had to correct it. Well, it's 13 antennas and it tunes, but it doesn't tune all the time.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Right. And so now we're learning that it's essentially a Chromebook, it's Chrome OS device, Chromium OS device. And so I have the feeling that Google is hatching a scheme here that we don't fully understand. For example, it would make a lot of sense for a future Chromecast, for example, to be a home automation hub, right? Or to work with a home automation hub or something. I think that what I'm saying is that I think that what's going to be interesting about the On Hub is not in the On Hub yet. It's they're priming themselves here for a future where they're going to do something interesting. So that's if that's not vague enough, then
well, there was speculation it might be a home automation hub.
Well, that's what it was supposed to
it
be.
Has it
was supposed
Zigbee to be in it, right? It has 802.11.14 or whatever that is.
Yeah, Barry, do you have any insight into this? Like, what do you think they're up to here?
I have no direct insight, but I'm thinking maybe you could even like start talking to it, asking it queries, get search
like
queries
Echo
back to you. Yeah, like what's the weather, stuff like
we
that.
We thought that too, because it has a speaker.
It
which
looks
is only
like an
used
Echo
for once in the whole time you ever use it.
Yeah.
To do the pairing.
Yeah.
That's the reason I kept it, because I think the future there's going to be major upgrades to it, but who knows?
Yeah, and it absolutely should be an Amazon Echo type of device. I mean, I'm just still so confused why Apple and Google aren't all over this category, why they're letting Amazon run away with it.
I think they, like many of us, didn't understand what the Echo meant until you use an Echo.
Right.
It just says, I could do that on my phone. What do I need a black plastic tube in the middle of my kitchen for to do something that's really not even as good as a Google Now search?
I know for a fact that the Siri and the Google Now that are both sitting on my phone are superior to Alexa, and yet I use nothing but Alexa when I'm at
love
home.
Love Alexa.
And we're going to be buying a
second one.
I figured
out why it is, by the way. Because you're talking to your house.
Yeah, that's right.
You're not talking to your phone. You're talking to your house, and your house responds. You know, it's really weird. Alexa, by the way, we're watching a video of the Rocketeers rooting this sucker, whatever they're called. This morning, my Alexa woke up, and I realized it's my ringtone. My ringtone is the Twit theme, and in it, it says, this is Twit, this is amazing, something like that. It woke up the Echo, because all of a sudden, my Echo starts playing you. Huh. I'm listening to the live stream of
what
TNT.
A great feature.
And it's, I think, my ringtone sets off the
okay.
Echo.
Okay, you just gave me an idea for a tip for the new screensavers. I'm going to do a tip that says, create a ringtone that wakes up Alexa and asks for the weather.
Oh.
So your phone goes off, and then you get the weather from Alexa.
Oh,
it's
I like
dumb,
it.
But,
it's dumb, but it would work.
Maybe I'll come up with something better than
it's
that.
It's kind of an annoying ringtone.
You're right. It is interesting because they're doing all this stuff on home automation and
right.
all these protocols. I'm thinking maybe, I mean, you walk into your car, you got Android Auto, you got...
I want everything to... See, this is the appeal of the Echo. I want everything to respond to me. Yeah. I want to be able to talk to wherever I am, whatever I'm doing. And you're right. The next thing would be in the car. Talking to the phone isn't quite the same thing, although right. Apple obviously is aware of this because they turned on Hey Shlomo as a... You know, the default.
Yeah.
It's always listening. And you have to spend some time. I'm sorry, Sailor Lion and Dr. Mom. They're annoyed because we've woken up their Alexa. I mean, their Echo. I call it the Echo. I try to get out of that by calling it the Echo. This does not look like something one would want to spend a lot of time doing, rooting your on-hub router. But Barry, you got one. So, you know, if you got some free time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This weekend, you might want to root it. The funny thing is, it's basically Chrome OS.
Yeah.
But why not? Why wouldn't you make a Chrome OS? Why would you reinvent the wheel?
Especially with all their development on the home automation side around Chrome. So maybe it'll be easier to plug that into your devices that way.
Yeah. It does lend one to think that all of these conspiracy theories about future capabilities are real, because that's why you put a real OS in what is essentially, you know, an IoT device.
Yeah.
It's interesting that these guys at the exploiteers said, you know, maybe we could do the same thing to this as we do to our Chromebooks to root it. And it worked.
I mean, I'm thinking, okay, so just before we let this topic go away, imagine that Moore's Law kicks in and further development and economies of scale and all the rest happen, and the price of this comes down to well under $100. So let's say it comes down to $79.99. Or maybe they subsidize it, and it's $59.99.
It should be
$49.99.
You know what? It's no better than a $50 router, right, Barry?
No, it's better than that. It definitely has much better range.
Oh, okay.
But I'm saying in the future, let's say they really go for cost. I mean, if you look at the cost of the Chromecast, it's so cheap. And if they had something that was maybe not as cheap as a Chromecast, but very inexpensive, and they pitched it as a Amazon Echo type of thing, where Google Now is available just to talk to your room, and they would encourage you to have multiple. You need one in the bathroom, you need one in the bedrooms, you need one, and then they would have a car version. It would be part of Android Auto.
I want it everywhere.
Put it everywhere. But imagine that all of those devices are also routers that auto switch and so on. How much great connectivity you would have.
You'd create a mesh.
Plus, they would be like the Chromecast audio. There would be speakers that would simultaneously link up and play music.
They have all the pieces. They need to put it all together, right?
Yeah,
and maybe Apple's. You know, Apple's going at this with the Apple TV because you could talk to that. Your TV is always there.
Yeah.
You know, hey, Siri on Apple TV.
A conspicuous lack of mention, though, in home automation features on the new Apple TV. We all thought that's what it was.
Yep.
And maybe it still is, but it's not apparent. They didn't seem to think that was important. I'm not sure home automation is that important, but I am sure that talking to your home is important.
Yeah.
And once you start talking, then you start expecting your home to be able to respond. So you expect to say, please open the garage bay door, Hal.
Yeah, right.
And it will open.
Yeah.
Somebody's at your door.
Yeah. Speaking of awesome products.
Somebody's rung your doorbell. That's so funny. He's got the ring.
Yeah.
So let's see here.
I think you teased before the ad that I was to launch another defense of Google Plus.
Are you? Can you?
Sure I can. Yeah. I'm going to make an argument for Google Plus.
Mike, it's a ghost town.
Well, that's what everybody says. It's basically been shamed to
even
the point
Google
where...
Even Google stopped mentioning it.
Yeah, Google is not supporting it the way they should. But let me just give you a couple of ideas to think about here. So the two social networks that really people gravitate
Facebook
and Twitter, have multiple problems. Okay, Facebook is in its own universe. You can't really compare it anymore to anything. So Facebook is Facebook.
It's become a gated community.
They have a monopoly on everybody.
And so
that's a separate thing. So you look at Twitter, and there are two problems on Twitter that are actual social, political problems. One of them is the shaming ritual.
I grant you that. Twitter is
successful. It's a pitchfork mob.
Yeah. You know what the latest one that pissed me off?
What's that?
And I think without Twitter, maybe Facebook, but I think without Twitter this doesn't happen. Meryl Streep is promoting her new movie, which you probably saw ads all over the Democratic, weirdly enough, the Democratic debate.
Yeah,
It's about British suffragette, the British movement to get the vote for women.
Yeah.
And she plays one of the leaders of that movement.
Yeah.
And they in the junket where they do the interviews, everybody in the cast... I think it was for Vanity Fair. It was for Time Out London, the Time Out magazine. They wore a T-shirt that said, "I'd rather be a rebel than a slave," which is a quote from the character that Meryl Streep plays, saying, "You know, I know, you know, it's upsetting to people that women want the right to vote, but I'd rather be a rebel than a slave."
Yeah.
And on Twitter, everybody started conflating that with the Confederacy and the Union and the Civil War. And they said, is Meryl Streep saying she'd rather be a Confederate than a slaveholder than a slave?
Right.
No, you nitwits. But if it weren't for Twitter and the nitwit culture on Twitter, that would not have happened.
Exactly. And there's a lot of that. There's a post I did this morning on Google Plus about there's a ritual that they have in the Chinese airline industry where if you work a certain number of hours and you're a flight attendant, you have to get inside the overhead bin.
What?
It's a hazing
ritual.
They called it hazing, but now there was so much Twitter outrage, or it's not Twitter, but the Weibo or whatever in China, that the industry is backtracking and they're banning it and stuff like that. And this is an internal cultural thing.
It's nobody's business.
Everybody is forming these mobs,
in the chat room, I think this is exactly right. Says outrage is in vogue. P.S.
It absolutely is, and a tiny minority of people can make themselves feel super good by being better and holier than everybody else, and they form this mob, and then they get this huge number of people who are who are ignorant, frankly, who back that just because they like the feel of the shaming that takes place and they feel powerful and like we're really changing things here. It's just an ugly thing. There's that. And then there's also the misogynistic silencing of women and minorities and homosexuals and others on Twitter that we've been talking about for a long, long time. The trolling.
Yeah, if you're not all a fat white stuff, boy right. on Twitter, you're just right. you're out.
Everybody complains about that stuff, but nobody does anything about it. The reason that stuff exists is that nobody leaves Twitter. They just keep using it. Whereas on Google Plus, get this, people have arguments. They have reasons, sometimes not reasoned, but oftentimes it's a very critical
place. I'm getting a lot more spam on Google Plus than I did before.
Exactly, because what's happening is that Google's rolling this out internationally. And so there's a lot of people in other countries mostly who are discovering that they can spam it. But you know, the tools for beating spam, for blocking people are super great on Google Plus. So I just keep knocking them down. And but again, Google Plus is the only place that I'm aware of that has exactly what the world needs besides love, sweet love, which is argument. You can actually have a sustained, reasonable argument that is not ruined by a lynch mob, that's not ruined by trolls, that's not ruined by anybody. It's like the well. It's today's well. And yes, it's a tiny minority of people are using it, but they're better people. I'm just going to say it. The people on Google Plus are better than the people on Twitter.
But what you get is a death spiral, whereas fewer people use it, then the people are, like, for instance, for some reason, I have four or five men's health magazine posts in my feed. I was looking because they're posting all the time and everybody else is backed off.
You have to be active. You have to block. You have to unfollow. Yeah. You have to mute. You have to use the tools. And so it's a ongoing process. In my case, I go in there and, you know, I get two or three comments every day from people that I don't want to have anything to do with. So I block them and they're gone forever.
Yeah.
And by doing that every day, I have a fantastic.
How important is it to plus one? Do you do a lot of plussing?
I don't see any value I don't think it has any signal value.
Okay.
I think it's
That's just a mistake, right?
I don't think it's a mistake. I just think, you know, it's a way to sort of give an attaboy to somebody else.
What we need is Bradley Horowitz needs to start putting some effort into this.
Yeah.
Get some elbow grease.
Well, I think it's been tainted by the lynch mob on Twitter, ironically. And this has been driven by the journalists who are obsessed with Twitter and who hate Google Plus for obvious reasons. I mean, that obvious reason is that they love to be influential without any effort. And that's what you can do on Twitter if you have a following.
Right.
On Google Plus, it's effort.
Work.
You have to argue every point, and everything you say is challenged.
Yeah.
It's a very contentious place, and it's not for lightweights, and it's not for people who are too busy doing other things to really engage with the stuff they say. So what people like to do is they like to write their articles. They spend their time on that if they're a journalist. Put it out there. Put a link on Twitter. Have people retweet it, and then they're done, basically.
Do you get, though, as a journalist, because I know you cross-post your Computer World articles, for instance, on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Google Plus.
Right.
Do you get a lot of engagement and traffic, more importantly,
well,
on Google Plus?
I'm a bad person to ask because I have a huge – I'm going to hit 5 million in a couple of months.
So you're 10 times more than I have.
I get 3,000 additional followers per day.
Because you're the last
on
person
Plus.
Posting.
Exactly. But so I'm not a good person to ask, but I get way more engagement
so
on Google
Plus.
So
you do get engagement.
Far more engagement, and it's great engagement. I mean, it's such a luxury because I'm blocking people left and right. I'm deleting comments, and I make sure that every conversation on Google Plus is just a great conversation with really smart people.
I should maybe.
That's what I need.
I should maybe spend more time here.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that Google Plus is not perfect, but look at how horrible Twitter is and look at how horrible Facebook is.
Right.
I mean, you know, everybody's on Facebook, but they don't want to talk about issues. They don't want to argue. They don't want to engage in, you know, and Google Plus is also great if you're into stuff. Like I'm super into making cheese. I'm super into making bread. And the bread community on Google Plus, the art of bread, is amazing. Like it's like the greatest resource for baking bread on the internet, and nobody cares.
I joined that group because I like looking at pictures of bread.
Right, but the Twitter journalist mob doesn't care about that. I mean, it's just irrelevant. But you know, that's an example of one of 10,000 enthusiasms where you find all these great people. So I don't really care if people are bad mouthing Google Plus all the time, and I don't really care that.
No, in a way, that's good, right? Because that drives off the the trivial people.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, on Google Plus, that's where all the Googlers are. For a show like this, to find the tidbits,
Well, you know what, Barry? I would disagree. That used to be. You don't get as many Googlers on Google Plus, which is part of the reason I think Google has lost interest.
Yeah.
It used to be, of course, you want to. Everybody I was following, half the people I'm following were Googlers. I don't see a lot of posts from them anymore.
I think the reason Google has lost interest is because it was an internal political thing.
It was Larry Page's thing.
Well, Google has become a little bit more like Microsoft as they've grown. So Vic and Dotra made Google Plus. He was full of fire and passion for Google
Apparently pestered Larry Page for years.
Exactly. Exactly. And when he left, it was kind of like, you know, the Sundar Pichai era began.
He's gone.
And that was like, I have the feeling there was a huge battle between Sundar Pichai and Vic Gundotra, and Vic Gundotra ended up leaving, and now it's Sundar Pichai's world. And so Google Plus is kind of like, you don't want to speak the G word within Google. So I'm just guessing. I mean, there are people who are very passionate about Google Plus and very knowledgeable about it. But again, how much of the internet can you really handle? Google Plus, as it is now, is far more content than I could ever even get close to.
You know what
consuming.
I realize? And by the way, I would probably... Do you use it on desktop or mobile?
Both. Mostly both. Desktop, but both.
What I find is that most of that stuff I use on mobile, and it's a diversionary tactic when I'm in line or I can't sleep or whatever. I reach for my phone. And I find I will go to Facebook and Instagram. I play chess online, so I'll play my chess game. And I less and less am hitting that Google. It's still on my front page, but I'm hitting it less and
less. It's not as accessible emotionally and psychologically as Twitter or Facebook.
Desktop.
With Twitter and Facebook, you can get a quick hit. What's happening? Right. With Google Plus, you're like, okay, I got to brace myself. I'm going in. You know, and then you got to go slog through and find the stuff.
So it could be improved. For instance, this button that says new posts, touch to see them. Is that the best way to do that? That's how Facebook does it.
The way to think about Google Plus, which nobody does. I'm similar to Robert Scoble in the sense that, like, I believe that I'm the only one who does it right. But anyway, here's how you look at Google Plus as a social search engine. So every circle that you have is a search. So if you go in and you find the Twit circle. I have a Twit circle, which is everybody who works at Twit.
I have that circle.
And so I go in there and I'm like, okay, I'm going to shift gears and I'm going to be engaging with Twit for a while.
And how many of us post there?
Lots.
Really?
Lots. Yeah, yeah. Jason Howell is huge on
Are
Google
you?
Plus.
Jason still likes it. That's good.
Yeah.
And actually, you do post your show stuff there, don't you?
We do our polls and
crowdsourcing and stuff. It's a great source.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but I'm very dialed into Google Plus's Android/Google side of things.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that are there that are passionate about that, too. So there's a lot of good conversation to be had around that.
All right. Sure. You talked me into it again. Every time you're on, Mike talks me back into using Google Plus. I admit Twitter sucks, but I noticed you've got it running.
It's easy.
I have it running. It's on all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Facebook, I always hate myself after I visit.
But I like Twitter, but I'm fortunate that I haven't been the subject of a pitchfork wielding mob yet.
Yeah.
And so it's great for me. It's not so great for the people who have been silenced by the trolls and by the haters.
The only way I can use it is by just having a thick skin and using liberal use of the mutant block.
Most people don't have the opportunity to develop such a thick skin. It took you decades.
It took me decades.
To have skin thick enough to deal with Twitter.
And it's still maybe not quite thick enough.
You know,
Barry, do you use Google Plus?
I do. I use it a lot. I do it the same way. I have my circles. I try to slice up my circle so that I can find certain content and engage in that and also cover that as a reporter.
I may need to do more circle management.
Yeah. Let me just give you one last pitch for why Google Plus is great. Google Plus, if you use it as a live streaming service. So what that means is that I post this to my immediate family. I post that to my extended family. I post this to public. I post this just to myself. Right. I post a lot of stuff just to myself, and I'm the only recipient. It's a secure way for me to remember everything. And then later, when I want to remember something, I go in and I type my name, and then I type the thing that I'm looking for, and it's a great search engine, unlike Facebook, which has zero search. It shows me exactly what I'm looking for. And then, of course, Google Photos is plugged into it as well, so I can find all the photos. So, for example, my son right now is in Barcelona, and I've lived in Barcelona, and he was asking me for restaurant recommendations. I went straight to Google Plus. I typed in Mike Elgin, Barcelona. I got most of the posts that were public. I also got some that were private. But every single post where I mentioned the B word, Barcelona, I saw laid right out in front of me.
It's a little life blog.
It's a life It's a live stream is what it is, and it's brilliant for that. Nobody uses it for that, but it's brilliant for
you
that.
You know what? I would use it for that if I could capture those into my blog
yeah.
for preserving
yeah.
them. And this is what you did. You stopped blogging, and you made right. Google Plus your blog.
Exactly.
And if they would just, for crying out loud, give us an API yep. that had yes. more than just reading,
yes,
then I might consider – I need to save it. I don't like putting all my content in a temporary basket.
Yeah.
So I would right. do that as long right. as I could get into my blog, but right. I can't do that right now. I
right.
don't think. Maybe I should look and see.
The other thing to keep in mind is
there's a read API.
Google Plus is very secure. Right. To the best of my knowledge, it's never been hacked.
Right.
Twitter's hacked all the time.
Google's good at this, yeah.
And so this is the thing that's so great about it. If you really pour yourself into it, you get a lot out of it. The other thing that Google Plus really needs is a Twitter view. They need... So I auto post.
It needs to be less of a silo and more yeah. a participant in
yes,
the.
Yes, exactly.
And that's where an API would help.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
We've just solved this. It's simple. All you got to do is make an API. So if you'd get to work on that, we'd appreciate it.
Barry?
Barry, you get to work on it.
Done.
No, I think it's going to have to be that that Brad fellow.
Yeah.
But do you think Brad's paying any attention to this anymore?
He's really been focusing on Google Photos, I know. I know that yeah. he still believes in it. But again, once again, I think the problem is just the – and I think it's so ironic that I literally think that the Twitter hate campaign machinery has badmouthed Google Plus into a reputation where it's not easy for anybody to be super enthusiastic about it.
Right.
You know? And so I'm glad
you are still.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, as a writer and a broadcaster, I kind of feel like I need it. Right. I need the crowds.
But what you probably don't want, and Bradley, I have to reframe this, is somebody posting their Twitter feed into Google Plus. Yeah. That would just trash it.
Yeah.
Although you could block them. That's the nice thing about Google Plus. It's very easy to get people out of your streams.
It is. And they're gone forever. Yeah. And it's just great. Works great. So.
All right. So you still use it, Barry, as part of your – is for you as professional too?
Yeah. I don't use it for family at all or for friends. It's all about me discovering content around topics that I cover as a journalist.
You know what's ironic? As we were talking about this and I'm going through my Google Plus feed, I found two stories that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah. In just a bit, we're gonna do that. But first, a word from Blue Apron. I love cooking. But I rarely have the time after work. I'm exhausted to go to the grocery store. That's very European, isn't it? You have a little string bag, and on the way home from work, you get a baguette, you get a tomato, you get a chicken. You bring home your ingredients. Blue Apron solves this problem in our modern hectic world by delivering those ingredients to your door fresh, straight out of the garden, never frozen. Even the meats and the fish, they're all refrigerated in this box. Ready for you to cook that night. And they come with these beautiful 8.5 by 11 recipe cards with glossy images, coated stock so you can save them later. I wish, you know what, a little tip, Blue Apron, hole punch those and give me a Blue Apron binder because I want to save all those recipes.
You know, you don't need that. You know why? Because their app has 100% of those recipes.
Oh, that's right. They're all online. In fact, videos are online too. So if you don't know how to dice an onion or, you know, some technique they're talking about. And by the way, you really learn. There's a lot. I cook stuff, and even ingredients I've never heard of.
Yeah.
I found a new bok choy in one of the recipes that is like my new thing, and I love it.
Yeah.
So you're going to learn a lot about ingredients, about cooking, about recipes, and you will gain confidence, and you'll make these incredible meals for less than $10 a meal. There are two different plans. There's the date night plan, you and another person. It's really, really a romantic way. To win somebody's heart, by the way, is to make a beautiful Blue Apron. Set out the candles, the tablecloth. They're going to love it. They're going to think you're a master chef. It's incredible. They also have a family plan with kid-friendly ingredients. The menus never repeat. You can always tell them what you do and don't want. They have vegetarian menu plans, for instance. It is just so great. How about one pot shrimp purlieu? Now, I didn't even know what purlieu was until I got the recipe for one pot shrimp purlieu. Or seared chicken and autumn vegetables with apple cider mustard jus. There's the shrimp purlieu.
Yeah.
It's a rice dish big in the kind of Cajun country. It's incredible, by the way. And every bit of the ingredients you need for it comes in your Blue Apron box. And exactly how much you need. So there's no waste. You need two scallions, they give you two scallions. Not three, not one, two scallions. Two of whatever you need, two ribs of celery. I mean, it's everything you need, never more. You do a little chopping, a little searing, a little sauteing, and boom, you got the best meal you ever had. And now you can cook it again, by the way. BlueApron.com. We got your first two meals free if you go to BlueApron.com/twit. I hate doing these ads because my mouth waters every time.
I'm craving Blue Apron.
I cannot.
the thing I personally that I love most about this is that they send you the ingredients that there's no way you're going to find that ingredient
in
a store. You'd have to go to San Francisco and find that one little
like
ethnic market.
Yeah, exactly.
And they just give it to you, and you're like, wow, I've never even heard of this.
Love them. You'll love them, too. First two meals free, blueapron.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of our podcast and of especially of this week in Google. So two stories I found in Google Plus.
Yep. The power of Google Plus.
The power of Google Plus. The breakthrough candidate in the Democratic debate last night, well, if you go by Google, it was Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
This is the graph of Google's search interest. Maybe it's because he said things people went, what? And they searched it. I don't
know.
Well,
you know, my theory is, and I know we don't like to talk about politics, but Bernie Sanders is a problem for the Democratic Party in the same way that Donald Trump is a problem.
He's unelectable because he's a socialist.
They don't want them to be more popular. Hillary is the Democratic Party's candidate in general. And Bernie Sanders is not. But he says the kinds of things that are real crowd pleasers. And I think that an objective analysis like this would show that Bernie Sanders won the debate, but
not in the media.
You go to the media and it's like, oh, clearly Hillary Clinton. You know,
I think what that
park.
Shows is that the machine is why a third party candidate has such a hard time in America.
That's right.
The machine is so powerful that even in media coverage, somehow, the machine candidate always is the winner.
Exactly. And this is part of the problem with our system. And I think that the tech angle in all this, of course, is that Lawrence Lessig, who is running...
I wish he'd get more attention.
Well, he's running on a single platform, which is to reform the corrupt system we have for elections, and he wasn't in the debate. Why? Because he hasn't reformed the system yet. The very thing that he wanted to fix kept him out of the debates, keep him out of the race, and will prevent him from ever having a chance of being elected. And I think that's really interesting. And it's a tech angle, of course, because he's been involved very heavily in a lot of technology.
Larry's been a regular guest on Twit. We interviewed him. He was our first triangulation episode. And he was, you know, for a long time, his goal was to eliminate DRM and to fix the music industry. And then he realized, well, you can't do that until you fix politics.
Right.
And then he realized you can't fix politics until you fix campaign contributions and the influence of money in politics. And then he realized you can't fix that outside, because of course the incumbents are the beneficiaries, so they're going to always vote to increase and continue this influence of money in politics.
Of course, they are.
The only way to get rid of it is to become an incumbent, get rid of it, and he says he will do that, and then he will pick a really good vice president, and he'll resign the day after he fixes the money issue. He says, I don't want to be president. I just want to – you have to be an incumbent to fix this.
And it'll never happen. There is one bit of hope, though, and I think that there's an internet or social media driver behind this, which is that the Bernie Sanders of the world and the Donald Trumps of the world, for whatever – regardless – forget their politics for a second. Forget their perspectives on anything for a second. The thing that people are responding to, I believe, above all, is the fact that they're unscripted. They're not the product – of a gaggle of handlers who are telling them exactly what to say and how to say it, because we know that this wins and that, you know, so on. This will get you through the whole process. They're basically speaking off the cuff. They're speaking in plain language, and people are responding to this. And I think it's because it has something to do with social media. And so that is a bit of hope there, that the people are seem to be
social media will be the democratizing influence on this. And I think that that's why you see this, like in this article, all of this traffic around Bernie Sanders, which you wouldn't see if you just read the mainstream media, that there was apparently a lot of interest. Either that or he said a lot of things people had to Google.
Yeah.
It's possible.
That's why I'm with you. I think that Drew Curtis
of FARC
should run for president.
He's running for governor of Kentucky, and maybe he'll win.
Yeah.
If he does, I think that's the next step.
Yes.
White House.
Yes.
I'll vote for him.
You can count on us.
Yeah. The two of us.
Yes.
We can't vote for you now, Drew, without voter fraud, but soon.
Yeah.
We also interviewed him, by the way, on triangulation. Yeah. I'm good at interviewing candidates who I don't have a Jensen.
Yeah. No. My mother was a journalist, and she interviewed Ronald Reagan when he didn't have a chance, and then he went on to
surprised everybody, didn't he?
Yeah.
So this is the other story I got from Google Plus. I got to do Google Plus more. You convinced me.
It's great.
Leaked screenshots showing we'd heard rumors for a while that Facebook was going to do a new breaking news notification app called Notify. Well, I guess they're getting close because this was reported by Business Insider and others back in August. Here's some screenshots. So this Facebook already has, you know, realized the strategy, and it was very effective, as you could see earlier when we talked about Messenger and how much Messenger growth is shown by splitting out stuff out of the main big blue Facebook app. A Notify app that would let you know, for instance, when Vivo has a new music video, or when there's new daily freebies and deals, or when BuzzFeed posts its most the trending stories.
What's interesting about Notify, I think, is that it's kind of like what they were sort of kind of trying to achieve with Facebook Home. Remember that when they wanted an Android user interface that went on top was essentially your lock screen. It was a flop, but they want to be the first thing you see. They want the phone to be a Facebook phone. They want the phone. They want to be what you see when you turn on your device.
Right.
And this would give them that because it grabs the notification screen.
It's as you said, they want to take over everything.
Yeah.
They want to own it all.
Yep.
And we finally know what the dislike button is, which is not a dislike button. I wish they were testing this. Have you seen this button in action, Barry, the new Facebook
button? I have not seen it at all.
You have to be in Europe somewhere, I think. So we only have screenshots. They're testing it right now, and I can't remember where. But the idea, and what do you think of this? Spain and Ireland only.
Yeah.
What the idea is, instead of just a thumbs up, you'll hit the thumbs up, press it hard, and you'll get these choices. A heart for love, a ha-ha smiley face, a yay face, a wow face, a sad face, which I think they did need because I hate liking the news that somebody's died.
Right.
And an angry face.
Yep.
But I've seen so many people say they hate this idea. What do you think, Barry?
Honestly, I hate Facebook.
You're the wrong guy.
I'm the wrong guy for this. I'm on This Week in Google. So
would it make you hate Facebook less?
No, this makes me hate Facebook more. It would be an angry face.
This is angry why face. If they can have emoji, we need the poo emoji so we can talk about Facebook. That's what I'm saying.
All right.
I mean, I think it's. I think if I can summarize why people object to this, the like function and the thumbs up imagery is iconic for Facebook.
Right.
It's what Facebook. It's so closely associated with Facebook.
Right.
To have all these other alternatives that are non-iconic feels like it's kind of like when Twitter says they're going to have algorithmically sorted feeds. It's like, well, that's not really what we signed up for. So I think that's an element, but it's practical. Like you said, somebody says, oh, this great person died. Do you like it because the person was great? Or so what do you do? You know, you need an action to take there. You need a neutral reaction, like wow. That wow could be positive, negative, doesn't matter, but it's a way for you to interact without saying, yeah, I like this, because content is too nuanced for just like or nothing. So I think it's a necessity for them to a certain extent, but people don't like it because it sort of doesn't seem Facebook-y.
Yeah. Well, now apparently, here's another one. If you put something on Facebook, presumably it was part of your day and your year. Facebook, of course, as you know, has an On This Day feature and a Year in Review feature, which will show you pictures from this day and previous years or your entire year. But apparently, sometimes those memories aren't welcome. And the social network has now given you a filter. I haven't been able to find this, but I'll have to find my On This Day preferences that will let you filter out bad memories.
Yeah, because right now it's like, oh, remember on this day 3 years ago when you lost your arm in that horrible industrial accident? Well, we want to remind you about that.
Well, why did you post it on Facebook if you didn't want to remember it?
Because I still had the other arm. So this is a good thing.
I guess it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I feel like, well, I mean, you have the choice. If you put it on Facebook, I think it feels like it should be fair game for your year in review.
I mean, the fact is that most users aren't going to touch any of these features, but right. it's now your fault. It's now, if you get something in your feed that you don't like, it's no longer Facebook's fault.
Whose fault is this? Playboy is no longer going to put nudes in its magazine.
It's the internet's fault. It's pornography.
They said it's Facebook's fault. I heard somewhere somebody blamed Facebook.
What the hell? So apparently Playboy itself says the online porn is why you don't need, it's easy to find naked pictures.
Yeah.
So you don't need that for Playboy. So for those of you who say, I read Playboy for the articles, well, guess what? It's true now, no matter what. Starting in March of 2016.
I think the Playboy is the Yahoo of
It's kind of content. Anachronistic, isn't it?
Yeah, they don't really have a reason to exist anymore. Yeah. And I don't know. This will give them a little bump of publicity where here we are talking about them. But they're pretty much done as a relevant
That's very strange.
Medium.
Very, very strange.
Yeah.
What else? Is there anything else I haven't talked about? Andy Rubin's, remember Andy Rubin was the guy who ran Android, in fact, invented Android, sold it, his company, to Google, and then ran it for a while at Google, left. He has an incubator called Playground, and they just closed a round of $300 million in funding. That means there are a bunch of rich people who gave Andy Rubin another rich person, $300 million to invest for them.
Yeah.
Because they figure, well, if anybody's going to do a good job investing my money, it'll be Andy Rubin.
Everybody wants to be a venture capitalist and throw the money around and be the kingmaker. But I don't understand how you walk away from what he walked away from. They basically said, Andy, we're going to put you in charge of, we're going to buy 8 robotics companies and you can be in charge of the whole thing. You get the Atlas robot, you get, you get the big dog robot. You can play with all that stuff and you can create this into, and he's like, that sounds interesting, but nah, I'm going to go be a VC. That was the coolest, he had the coolest job in the valley. He's in charge of all the robots.
Yeah.
It was so cool. And he walked away from that. Or maybe he was pushed out. Who knows? But
And, Calacanis was on the new Screensavers a few weeks ago. Jason Calacanis, you know him.
Yes.
Made a lot of money selling. He was a blog entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Created, among other things, Engadget.
Yeah.
And sold it all to AOL for something like $113 million.
He did well for himself.
Did well. He's quite a character, and he's been investing as an angel investor ever mm-hmm. since and doing well. He told me I should become an angel investor. You should become an angel investor. He said the best angel investors are the whole key in investing. He says, first of all, it's well understood the mathematics of the game. 80% will fail, 20% right. will succeed. You figure out which 20% are going to succeed of your investments. You kill the others, mm-hmm. and you double down on the 20. It's kind of like if you've got a good hand, you in 21 in blackjack, you split your kings.
Right.
Then you double down on those. He says it's very algorithmic. He says the key is access, is information flow. The key is access to the startups. And he said this is why Al Malik became a VC.
Yeah.
This is why so many tech journalists have become VCs because they have the best access to deals.
Right.
They know what's going on in the valley.
Yeah.
So we're wasting our time here.
If I wasn't going to be wasting my time, I wouldn't have got into journalism. I mean, it's a vow of poverty. So it's a little, off the track. But you're absolutely, here's what we do. We should do an alphabet-like restructuring for Twit, right? And I can run the VC wing. We can call it.
That's good. Twit Ventures.
Yeah, Twit Ventures. Exactly.
Barry, you want in on this?
Yeah, sign me up.
Have you considered that ever? I mean, here you are. You're sitting in the catbird seat. You got a ringside seat. You know where the big guys are going, where the money's going.
So I'm in the consulting business. So everybody comes to me, do you want a piece of my business in exchange for building it? And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Because people coming to me are not the big players, but I feel it's more important for me to build out software and features that I think I could control.
Oh, that's so anachronistic. You want to create something instead of just getting rich? What are you, nuts?
I know, right? Like, why would I get into a niche selling synagogue software? That's so small.
Yeah, you should demand a percentage of the synagogue donations.
Yeah.
That would be big. Yeah.
That would be huge.
So I remember there was a PR woman. I don't remember the name. I think it was Antenna. Remember Antenna PR or Antenna?
No.
She was very smart. She said to companies, I will do your PR for you as a startup for you. Just give me 1,000 shares. And if you're a startup, you're worth nothing.
Yeah.
She did very, very well. I think among other companies, there were some pretty big names in there, like Google.
You know, and what's funny about that is what's interesting, of course, is when you're when you're an investor, if you strike it rich with a 2% of your investments, you're doing great.
Well, that's right.
You're going to fail on most of them, and this is essentially the same bet.
It's like the guy who painted the mural at Facebook. Remember that?
No.
Yeah, Mark said, I can't pay you to paint this mural on the wall, but I'll give you stock. Millionaire.
Yeah.
It's like the massage therapist in the early days at Facebook.
Yeah.
Multi-millionaire.
Yeah. I had a friend around 1999 or whatever that he had good friends of his that were neighbors, and they had this incredible McMansion. And they were I think the woman who in the couple was she was a personal assistant or something at Yahoo when they went public.
Nice.
And she got a little bit of stock, which was huge back then. And yeah, that's good work.
But you got to know when to hold them, and you got to know when to fold them. That's right. I hope she sold that Yahoo stock promptly.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All right, here's from our chat room the latest video from Google Play Music, a 360 degree experience. This is on YouTube. Hey, before we play this, I just want to mention that I watched the Democratic debate last night in my Gear VR.
How boring was that?
It was nauseating, but I wasn't sure if it was the content.
It's hard to tell.
But it was actually very cool. I couldn't do it for more like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But they had cameras on the stage on left and right, and they started off with a camera way in the back.
Yeah.
And, these VR cameras, they look like just weird, like golf balls with lots of cameras on them. And I'm sure people didn't realize what that was because I'm sitting here at the beginning, and I'm looking down. There's a guy looking at his phone. I can look right at his phone. I'm looking over here. The camera guy, he's chewing gum. And he's like next to me. I'm looking, hey, how you doing? And then I could see like Sheryl Crow tucking in her shirt before she came out. Like they show the Steadicam guy. You're backstage with the Steadicam guy and Sheryl Crow. And she doesn't realize there's a golf ball camera right there. This is going to change the world. You're going to be able to spy on all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was actually a very interesting experience. And you know why it's good for the debate? Because you're not dependent on the director's cut to see what the reactions are. So you can look at each candidate as the other candidates are talking.
Exactly.
And actually, I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
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 So let me see. Turn your volume up. What are we going to see here? Okay. Oh, this is that thing where you can watch a video. Oh, but I have to get the controls working. So you're watching a music video. What's that? Why is it pointing at that? Should I go there? Oh, whoa. Let's not. Wow.
A mouse is not a great interface for VR.
No. You want to wear this with but I can't show you what it looks like with the helmet on.
Exactly.
That's interesting, though. Do you think there'll be more 360-degree music videos? When I get that Ricoh Theta S in a couple of weeks, I'm going to do the podcast at 360 degrees.
Yeah.
Then you'll be able to see the engineers screwing off in the back. While I'm working. Hey, I want to thank you, Barry Schwartz, for being here. Barry writes at searchengineland.com. I hope the thing with the Shul Cloud works out okay. The Europeans don't get you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
It's great being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. At Rusty Brick on the Twitter. Anything you want to plug?
So if you are in Israel, we're holding a conference for Search Marketing Expo, which is part of the Search Engine Land brand, November 1st on a Sunday. So if you are in the Israel region, go to searchmarketingexpo.com/Israel and sign up for the event.
Nice. That's great. And, of course, searchengineland.com, the place to read Barry's bylined work. Oh, look, see, now he's driving in the car on the 360 video.
Hmm.
And I can look outside the window.
Hmm.
Can't look behind me, though. Who's in the back seat? We'll never know. I like this idea. I think we're going to see a lot more of this, right?
Where yes,
you can
we
look
are.
Around. I don't know if they're...
I've just recently started an oldish book called Ready Player One, which you're very familiar with, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And that is such a clear vision of where this is all going.
Yeah. Just a matter of time.
Depressing, but clear.
I love it. I love it. Although, Some people still get nauseous. I tried it. Yeah. Lisa was going to watch the Democratic debate in the thing, and she, for like 5 seconds, she said, oh, I'm getting queasy. I can't do it. But she's a Republican, so maybe there's other reasons why. Mike Elgin, it's great, always great to have you, and your spirited defense of Google Plus.
Somebody's got to do it.
Keep on tilting it, Will, like Windmills.
Yeah, thank you.
You catch Mike every Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific,
that's right.
1 p.m. Eastern time for Tech News tonight. Today. That's our morning news program.
That's right.
And pretty regularly now on Twig, which is great. I love having you here.
Yeah, it's great. I love
thanks to Jason Howell, our producer. Put together a great show.
You betcha.
And by the way, if you didn't see All About Android from last night, they had the new Robin phone, right?
Yeah, Nextbit Robin. We had the folks from Nextbit in the house. And it was a great interview. We got to kind of play around with the Robin, which if you haven't seen it from the Kickstarter, well, it looks like you just pulled it up. Very unique, different looking design.
It looks just like this, although
it was comfortable. It looks very rigid, and that was my main concern. Was
sharp,
you know,
corners.
It's very sharp. You know, it looks very sharp on the corners, and it's actually a pretty darn comfy device.
You can chip ice with it.
He says definitely January. They're on track to get it out when they said they would get it out, which with Kickstarter is never a given. In fact, another 3D printer company just went belly up after raising some $3 million on Kickstarter. Yeah. Said, you know, those of you who haven't gotten your printer, you're not going to get it. This one, though, I think they're going to come through. They have some the people behind it are pretty sharp.
Scott Croyle, who we had on last night, he was pretty much the main design guy behind the original HTC One series.
Yeah.
So, you know, and in my opinion, that's one of the devices that really elevated Android device design.
I agree.
And everybody kind of played catch up from there. So pretty influential as far as that's concerned. So it's interesting to see them doing something so different.
It will be interesting to see. I ordered one, so I'll be getting mine in January. The thing that's unique about this, it's a little bit constrained on memory. What's 32 gigs? Or 16, I can't remember. It's not a lot of storage. But the reason is apps, when you don't use them, go up to the cloud.
Yeah.
And when you hit them, if you want it back, it'll re-download it after a short period.
And it does it kind of smartly for you, so you don't have to manage that. In fact, you can't explicitly say, send this one up to the cloud. It does it all for you. And it was very interesting. He demonstrated that by recording a video that was longer than the storage capacity left on the device.
Cool.
And you never knew. You never knew it because in the background, it was doing the things and making the decision to send an app you haven't used in months up to the cloud to make more space for it. It's very cool.
Well, watch All About Android from last night. As always, a great show if you're an Android fan. Thank you for being here. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern Time, 20:30 UTC. If you like to watch live, please do, twit.tv/live. But if you can't, on-demand audio and video always available after the fact, twit.tv/twig, or on youtube.com/thisweekingoogle. Or wherever you get your podcasts, because we're everywhere. I hope you'll subscribe and download each and every episode. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.